State first.
Yeah, my name is Chris Bell, and I'm at the home of Air Marshal Dunlap out in Oak Bay. And today's date is the 1st of March, 1983. And we're going to be dealing with today the social side of military life, primarily, or specifically, in the 1920s and 30s, the interwar period. And Air Marshal Dunlap was a young officer in the Air Force at the time. And, sir, I think you want to begin by telling me about the bases.
Yes, I think it'd be a good idea to set the stage first, because the RCAF, you know, in between the war years and the 20s, was a very small embryo force.
How large was it, just for general information?
Well, when it was formed in 1924, April the 1st, 1924, I think the total number of officers was something around 70.
70, all told?
And all told, headquarters and field establishments, and the number of troops would be less than 1,000.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a small force. It's rather remarkable the amount that was accomplished in that small force, but mm-hmm. It was a small force. And therefore, there were quite a limited number of bases and establishments.
Mm-hmm.
I think the headquarters staff, interesting to note this, totaled not more than 12 officers. And I suppose the administrative secretarial staff would not anything more than double that, if that. So,
would this headquarters staff, would they be stationed at one single
headquarters staff? I'm talking about Air Force headquarters in Ottawa.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I guess it wasn't even called Air Force headquarters in Ottawa in those days, because it was the Air Force was still under the Army for general administration.
Mm-hmm.
So it was the operational, more or less the operational and personnel element of the headquarters that was there. So it would be the headquarters, the air section of the headquarters staff, DND Ottawa, that we're talking about.
I know this is off the beaten track, but it interests me. What sort of ranking officer would be in charge of that detachment?
The senior officer of the Royal Canadian Air Force on the first day of April 1924 was a wing commander. And interestingly enough, it was Wing Commander Barker.
Mm-hmm. Billy Barker.
Yeah, one of the famous, the pal of, and the, well, the peacetime companion of Billy Bishop in one or two ventures. And I think it was, wasn't his name Bob Barker? Forgotten. But at any rate,
had he not been injured rather severely near the end of the war, and had he recovered sufficiently?
That is right. He was severely injured. Indeed, I had a letter, a copy of a letter. No, I had the letter he wrote to his CO from the hospital
mm-hmm.
after that injury, in which he was apologizing for his CO for getting so badly battered up.
And having his sup with snipe, I think it was.
That letter is now in the archives in Ottawa.
Yeah.
Yeah, all right. A wing commander was the senior officer.
Mm-hmm.
In the whole of the force at that time, there were, I think, four wing commanders.
Yeah.
Two of those were overseas on course, one at the Staff College, RAF Staff College, one on some other duty overseas, some other course, I've forgotten what it was. So, there were only two wing codes in Canada, one at headquarters in Ottawa, mm-hmm. and one was the base commander, Camp Borden. Base Commander Camp Borden was considered one of the key posts because that was the big station. And I believe at that time it was Wing Commander Lloyd Bredner, who was one of our outstanding chiefs in later years.
Had he been a First World War pilot?
Oh, yes. These fellows are all. On the first day of April 1924, every officer in the force, I would say, had been a World War I pilot.
Mm-hmm.
You could make an exception, I guess, in the case of Roy Slemon and one or two others who were not members of the force on that date. They were, I think they became members of the force about a month or so later than that.
Mm-hmm.
But they were young provisional pilot officers under training.
Mm-hmm.
But all the others were World War I.
I suppose it would be rather difficult for a young man to get in because of the vast amount of experience of the First World War pilots and the fact that they were still...
Well, yes, it had been up till 23, but in 1923 they took this decision
mm-hmm.
that it was essential to bring new blood in.
Mm-hmm.
And it was at that time that they started that first what they call PPO chorus, Provisional Bound Officer Chorus, and that was the one Stoneman was on. There were about 8 or 9 on that chorus, but only a few of those came into the service. Two were killed, I think, and 1 or 2 failed to qualify as pilots, so it dwindled down to a small number. But however, let's carry on. I mentioned the headquarters. Mm-hmm. It's very small. There were a limited number of bases, or stations as they were called, the chief of which was Camp Borden. Camp Borden was the center where all the training, flying training, was done. Camp Borden had been active in the several years.
Okay, we're back.
Yes, she's got us. Okay. Camp Borden was active. There was a predecessor to the RCAF that perhaps I should mention in passing. Mm-hmm. Between the war years, World War I, and the formation of the RCAF, there was the CAF, the Canadian Air Force, and it was sort of a component of what was called the Air Board. And Camp Borden operated as the chief, one of the chief military elements in the Air Board, in that the flying training that was done, and the refresher, it was mainly refresher flying training for the World War I pilots, was all done at Camp Borden. Mm-hmm. And the name of the force was the CAF, the Canadian Air Force. The uniform was different from the uniform of the RCAF. It was a dark blue.
Following the RAF pattern, I suppose.
No. It was a dark blue, quite different from the RAF pattern. It wasn't until the RCAF was formed that the uniform became similar to the RAF pattern. Mm-hmm. It was at that time the steel gray was introduced. But
did the CAF last for long?
It was formed in 1919. It really essentially didn't come into being much until 1920. And it lasted until the RCAF was formed in 1924. Mm-hmm. And the latter phases of 23, I guess, it was beginning to phase out. But officially, it lasted until 1st of April 1924. Mm-hmm. Now, so Camp Borden was the main station. That's where the bulk of the remaining officers and personnel of the force were located. But there were...
When you say bulk, pardon me for interrupting, but how many... did this bulk entail?
Well, let's say about 3/4 of the force.
Okay.
There were small stations elsewhere across Canada because we were involved with flying for civil government and federal government departments, mm-hmm. Provincial government departments and federal government departments on photographic survey, on forestry patrol, on
Rescue,
rescue was a bit incidental in those days. You were pulled off some other job to go on to a rescue job. It wasn't an organized rescue organization. On customs patrols and on various missions in the North Country to do with the Indians and assistance to the RCMP and covering the vast territory of the Arctic and so on. So
you said but customs. Does that also include the bootlegging to the
prohibition? Yes, bootlegging and prevention of smuggling of dope, things mm-hmm. like that. Mm-hmm. There was an element, a section out here in BC that was watched every CPR liner that came in because there was a habit of dropping a water type package with a float attached off the ship as it came in the harbor, and somebody would just scoop would it. Be watching with their blockers and go out and pick it up. You had to watch for that sort of thing. Well, all right. Apart from, in order to undertake these various missions, there was a base at Dartmouth, a very small one. I think it's generally referred to as Eastern Passage, Nova Scotia, but it was near Dartmouth. It is now, it later became RCF Station Dartmouth, and then later became RCN Station Shearwater, mm-hmm. and is now one of the bases of Air Command. It's the principal military base in the Halifax area. But it was very small. I suppose there couldn't have been more than a dozen personnel on that base.
Can you talk about a dozen officers, a dozen?
All told, maybe.
Indeed.
Maybe between a dozen and 20. I'm just giving you my recollections at random.
They would have been flying seaplanes, I should think.
Oh, yes, yeah. Yeah, and that was the base. Interesting passing to mention. That was the base that Admiral Byrd operated from in World War I.
Really?
That base was developed for the anti-submarine operations in support of the convoys going out of Halifax.
Mm-hmm.
And it was developed in 1918. The RCN was going to man it in due course, but they hadn't any organization to do so. And while they were having personnel trained, and they were being trained by the U.S. Navy, the Americans sent up a squadron, which was divided between Halifax and North City, Nova Scotia. Admiral Byrd was in charge of that whole operation. So he lived, they built about a quarter for him what is now Shearwater. And I, incidentally, lived in that quarter when I was on detached operations down there in 1929.
No,
it's a very historic little place, and I was very upset 30 or 35 years later on visiting there, I guess 40 years later, to find that it had disappeared. Nobody knew what on earth had happened to Admiral Byrd's quarter. It's built especially for him. And I was interested in it because I thought it should have a plaque put up and this event commemorated. He was a commander at the time, Commander Byrd. But it had disappeared, and I think it disappeared at the time they were building their quarters down there. I did find out that it was used as the office for the construction firm who were building the main quarters, it was immediately adjacent to that. And I've always contended that if you made a careful search down at Cal Bay, which is a resort area not too far, many miles removed, you'll probably find that quarter was moved lock, stock, and barrel by the contractor, and it's somebody's summer cottage down there. All right. the RCF also had a small base at Roberval in Quebec, and they were concerned mainly with forestry patrol and timber cruising for the big pulp paper interests in that area.
Mm-hmm.
And the work there was partially for the Quebec government and partially for the Quebec government on behalf of the big firms operating in that area. That's probably the way it was. Then there was a base at Ottawa called Ottawa Air Station. It's now called the Rockcliffe.
Is that a large establishment?
It was small, too, and it was experimental, and they did a number of experimental operations from there in connection with photographic survey. That was sort of the beginning and the start of photographic survey in Canada. And the RCAF eventually photographed the whole of Canada from Atlantic to Pacific and from the 49th parallel to the North Pole.
The entire Canada?
The whole thing. And the maps that we use now came from those photographs, mostly vertical pictures looking straight down, each photograph a map in itself, overlapping the next and so on. But also, initially, oblique photographs too, because that was a quicker way of covering it. That was for rough mapping, and then but for the fine, accurate mapping, the vertical came later on. The main center, after that, after this development work was done in Ottawa, the main base for survey missions became Winnipeg. It had a good center location. So there was Winnipeg Air Station with detachments out at Lac Du Bonny, not too many miles out from Winnipeg, 100 miles, I guess. Another small one up at the Paw, and the main one up at Cormorant Lake, Norway House, and places like that. And they did not only photo missions on those detached operations, but they did forestry patrol. There was a great deal of effort in forestry patrol against forest fires. And then many of the support operations for the surveyors who were going out to do the ground survey work, and they had to back up the aerial survey work with ground survey parties, so they were owned by this group. And also the payment of the treaty money to the Indians mainly emanated from that center, and the officials were flown out to remote areas to take care of missions like that. And then, of course, the RCMP didn't have an air service in those days, and they were flown various places, particularly the Commissioner U.S. Inspecting Detachment. That was the Manitoba operation. The next base at Winnipeg was second in size to Camp Borden. I can't remember offhand, because I wasn't, although I flew in and out of that area in 1929, to be exact. I was never stationed in that area. I delivered a new aircraft from Montreal up to northern Manitoba, and therefore I was at some of their bases en route. But I would say that the total number of officers involved would not be more than 18 to 20. Most of them would be pilots, and one or two would perhaps be photographic officers or technical ground engineer officers, something like that, but most of them be pilots. And,
Would Winnipeg be given the designation of the squadron at this point?
No, it wasn't. It was just a station. And these were detachments. There were a whole group of detachments. I guess there were a total of 9 detachments, 8 or 9, on photographic missions from Atlantic to Pacific.
Mm-hmm.
For example, I was initially on detachment, photographic detachments in Nova Scotia and then in Quebec and Ontario, and then I hopped out here to BC, and the detachment number here in BC was number 1 PD, photographic detachment. And those detachments were interesting to know the size of them. I think she'll get that. She's at her desk. The detachment consisted generally of 2 aircraft, 2 seaplanes, 2 float planes, 2 pilots, 1 for each aircraft, 3 NCOs, or airmen. Generally there were a corporal, maybe a couple of corporals and a sergeant, 2 of whom were fitters, as we referred to in those days. Those were the people that worked on the engines, and 1 was a rigger who looked after the airframe and so on. So that was the size of a detachment. It was a very small unit, generally operating in a very isolated area.
Mm-hmm. Would you fly in and out with your detachment on board?
What normally happened, I'll take a specific example out here in BC. We were generally given a block of territory 2,500 miles in size, 50 miles square.
Mm-hmm.
And as there was no radio or no MET service in those days, you had to have a base someplace. You had to set up an operating base within that territory so you visually could see what the weather was like and whether it would be suitable for photographic operations. There's no sense going up there if clouds are going to intervene between the camera and the ground. So it had to be good weather, really almost what they in these days call caboo, feeling invisible, the unlimited. That's a term you may not know, but caboo weather. And you therefore would establish base and operate from it until that block of country was completed. And you generally had 1 or 2 reserve areas lined up waiting for you. Once you finished one block, you then establish base and move to another one.
Mm-hmm.
And you did that all on your own. You didn't have anyone, there was no logistic organization behind you to. You arrange to get your fuel in there and get your food in. If it was an isolated place, get your food in, get your tents in, and set up camp, and get your film in and out, because you might take as many as 600 photographs a day. Each aircraft would take about 600 photographs a day. You'd take 1,000 large photographs that size, and they had to be processed, sent out for processing, and they had to be sent back to make sure that you hadn't left any gaps between the lines. You flew lines 50 miles long, you see,
mm-hmm.
back and forth like furrows on a plowed field. And if you got gaps between, then they had to be reflown to cover those gaps.
Mm-hmm.
You weren't supposed to get gaps. Mm-hmm. However, we digressed there. I'm still telling you about the bases.
Mm-hmm.
Leaving Manitoba, the next small established base was High River, Alberta. Everybody knows where High River is now since Joe Clark came to office, his hometown. And it was established there for the sole purpose of forestry patrol in the southern part of Alberta and in the foothills of BC in that area.
Mm-hmm.
They operated land planes from there. That wasn't a seaplane operation. It was one of the 2 land plane operations, DH-4 and DH-9 aircraft, things like that. All World War I aircraft. And that was a tiny sergeant. I think there were 6 officers there, the famous characters. And as you notice on the detachments, there were only 50% more ground crew than there were aircraft, and that applied pretty regularly. I think at High River, there would only be about twice as many fitters and riggers and ground personnel as there were officers. So it would be make All told, High River wouldn't be more than 20-odd people. But it had an important role to play. Punch Dickens was one of the pilots at High River in those days. You know, he's a famous bush pilot. He's retired living here in Victoria now. Mm-hmm. I play golf against him. He was World War One pilot. Now getting up about... He was one of the youngest of the World War One pilots. He's only 83. Most of them are... The average age now, those chaps, is about 86, 87. And then, of course, you hop over to Jericho Beach. That was the West Coast base. And Jericho had a multiple function. It was concerned with, some extent, with forestry patrol, some extent with the customs. And I didn't mention fisheries yet. On both coasts, there were fisheries patrols, particularly in B.C., supervising the restrictions on fishing and the areas and times that fishing is permitted. And then there was the photographic survey. And on top of that, Jericho Beach, which is, I better identify it, you may know where it is, but it's over there at Vancouver, I'd say, on the inlet leading in towards Vancouver Harbor. Mm-hmm. Very attractive spot, very suitable place for seaplane and boat flying. They had both boats and float planes there. It served also, as I was about to say, as the training center for the training of seaplane pilots. At Camp Borden, they trained landplane pilots. But we flew so much seaplane work in those days that you had to convert those landplane pilots to seaplane. You had to teach them airmanship, seamanship, as well as airmanship, and also teach them the special problems of landing on water, particularly glassy water. Mm-hmm. Glassy water, which is like a mirror, is very difficult to tell where the water is. It's like when you look down in the mirror, you're not sure whether you're looking at what you're seeing. There's no movement at all, and the water was a mirror on many occasions in these mountain lakes. It was a technique that was quite different from land plane flying, but once learned, it was quite easy. Could be very hazardous. We lost quite a number of aircraft flying right into the water, not realizing they were there, or leveling out, making their landing 20 or 30 feet up, thinking they were at the water. Both of those are rather unwise things.
Yes, I think.
Yeah. Okay, well, that's
was that in BC, just Jericho Beach?
Jericho Beach, that was it.
Nothing on the island?
Nothing on the island, nothing at all. No. But you see, by the time we started the photographic operations out here, which was in either 27 or 28, I've forgotten which, 28 I guess it was, then those number one photographic detachment was establishing bases wherever they had a job, and we photographed the whole of Vancouver Island, for example, at one stage, and then Queen Charlotte's, and then the Okanagan, and the Caribou, and the Chilcootin, and then the mountain areas down there, mm-hmm. in between, and way up in the Peace River area, and so on.
So they were all rather...
But there were bases. For example, my first base out here was at Shuswap Lake, Salmon Arm, across from Salmon Arm at Sandpoint. And then we went to Williams Lake, and then there was a base up at near Prince George. And on the island here, we were at Nimkish Lake, way up in the northern area. It was very isolated in those days. There weren't any highways or roads up there. And we were at Campbell... not at Campbell River itself, but upriver from Campbell River, and... in towards the lakes behind the Campbell Lakes.
Mm-hmm.
Nootka Sound, Sproat Lake, Shawnigan Lake, and so on.
Were you up on your history? Did you appreciate Nootka Sound when you were there?
Oh, yeah.
Did you?
Yeah, we got a bit of that there, because there was one other... we weren't absolutely alone. Nootka Sound was very isolated in those days.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a fish meal plant there, and it employed about a dozen people. And the manager of the fish meal plant was aware of the early history of that, so we got briefed, and I wouldn't have known otherwise had not been for that. So Jericho Beach again was a base on which in the early days at the formation of the RSAF, it only had about six officers.
Yeah. Specifically teaching staff as well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, a little bit. I'm talking about 1924. As you get on towards 28, 29. There were more there because there were more instructors there at that time. 24, they weren't even using it as an instructional station. It came on a little later. I went there in, first of all, 1929, and there were, I suppose, there there were six of us under training. There were six, I mentioned six officers under training there, and then there would, I suppose, be four or five instructors. I guess the staff wouldn't be much more than six or eight even then, but between instructors and pupils, there were a dozen or 15 officers on the end. Now, that gives you a rough idea.
What we had.
Yeah, and you see, it was a pretty unstructured organization, and not a very formalized establishment as far as accommodation or social life is concerned. In many occasions, the young officers of the RCF were out in the bush. We were bush flying, really.
Mm-hmm.
We were doing jobs for the civil government, which in later years were the civilian pilots were able to take over and do. But in the formative years, the RCF did that on behalf of the various levels of government. It took us out into remote areas where we were not in direct contact most of the time with organized society. We might be the only people in the area, or we might be adjacent to a small group of Indians or a small community like... there might be some other government officials like forestry patrol personnel or mm-hmm. or survey personnel, but you very often be quite out in the blue.
Quite sure. Well, let me ask you this. You say you have perhaps a half a dozen men in a detachment, a few more perhaps.
Well, in a detachment you had a total of five,
okay.
Two officers and three NCOs.
Okay. Within that group of five, how was discipline maintained, or how informal were the relations between officers and ranks and NCOs?
Yeah. Well, there wasn't really much of a problem in exercising discipline. I think that the NCOs appreciated the fact that they had to abide by a certain code of discipline, which wasn't going to be thrust upon them because they were operating so intimately with their officers. For example, the normal crew of the aircraft in a photographic detachment, and this would apply to many of the other detachments, forestry patrol and other things, would be one officer and one airman. You work together in the air, you work together on the ground, often preparing for flight. Sometimes in emergency operations, the officer had to pitch in and work side by side with the airman in order to there might be some emergency on, or there might be, there was always an emergency in photographic operations if the weather happened to be fit, because you had to take full advantage of it. You might, sometimes, fine weather comes in spells, you get these high pressure ridges that come and stick on above you for sometimes a week at a time or more.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got to work almost 18 hours a day together to take full advantage of that. Mm-hmm. So discipline as you normally think of it in the service would not have been quite appropriate in an attachment like that. You had to have a very intimate, friendly arrangement in which officer respected the NCO and NCO respected the officer without any hard and fast rules about it. And it worked out really quite well.
Mm-hmm.
You weren't intimate enough that
you
were on a first name basis. They understood that, we understood that. And they understood that they had to, and there were certain codes of behavior that were expected, and they were all fine lads, and there was no difficulty in that regard. They had to toe the line when it came to being on the job and being fit to be on the job.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody did anything to themselves by overconsumption of alcohol and wasn't fit for the job, they were there for the high jumps. Or there occasionally you get some creature in life is never on time, and then people are just born that way, and you might have both. Discipline didn't do there. I can remember, we haven't got enough time to go into some of these stories, but I'll tell you this one.
Okay.
I had, and when I was in the Queen Charlotte Islands, we were based in Queen Charlotte City, I don't know if you've ever been up there, but Queen Charlotte City doesn't really deserve the name of a city because it had just a few handful of people, maybe 100 or 200 people all told.
Mostly natives, I should think of that.
The natives were in a separate village. Now, these were primarily merchants and administrative personnel, and government officials, fisheries officials, and so on. The town. Let me see. I was up there in, I guess it would be about 1932. Mm-hmm. And 32 was about the depth of the Depression in Canada. But the Depression had hit Queen Charlotte City about almost 10 years before that. It was that bad because it really came to the peak of its activity during World War I because it became the center for the organizing of the gathering and shipping of Sitka spruce for the spars of the aircraft of World War I. Most of the wing spars in the aircraft of World War I came from Queen Charlotte Islands. Not many people know that.
No.
My wife's father was involved in setting that operation up there and getting that Sitka spruce out of there. And so there was a little bit of a boom.
Mm-hmm.
Not a big boom, but a little boom. There and the town. Therefore, a number of people came and lived there. And then when the war ended, that stopped. And there was very little logging done. And the logging was all done down in these areas that were close to civilization. There was very little logging done up there right after the war.
Mm-hmm.
That ended things. So Queen Charlotte City was in decline and depression. And when we went there in 1932, there was a so-called hotel called the Premier Hotel, and it was the upper floor of the general store. And the general store was owned by Mr. McKenzie. Groceries and hardware, and flour and feed and everything you can think of. And he and his wife had operated the hotel. It had about 8 rooms upstairs. There hadn't been a guest in that hotel for 7 years when we went there. And nobody had slept in one of those beds for 7 years. And of course, Queen Charlotte is the wettest part of B.C. And you can imagine what those mattresses were like. Well, I'm digressing a little bit. Of course, the plumbing was not indoors, it was outdoors. And it was up the hill a little bit from the back of the house. And I'd had trouble with this, with one of my corporals. He was an English boy.
Mm-hmm.
Squires by name. He had been late on a recent occasion, and of course that's a terrible crime when you're trying to get off and get into the air to take advantage of the weather. And I had read the riot act to him, and he was, I think, determined he wasn't going to be late again. But here, we had the sudden improvement of the weather, therefore early luncheon was laid on, and we were going to be at luncheon at a certain hour, and we got into luncheon, Squire wasn't there,
mm-hmm.
and he didn't appear. In the pier, and we were pretty well finished our meal when we heard a bit of banging out behind the building. And what had happened was this was a sort of a two-holer, and when he'd gone in there and banged the door in his hurry, the button was really not centered properly, and the heavy part of the button turned. And he was locked in. And he screeched and shouted. But the only person who heard him was the waitress that Mrs. McKenzie had hired specially to look after us. And she had come from a farm over near what is now the Sandspit Airport.
Mm-hmm.
And that, in those days, was so isolated that the children of that family, rarely ever saw anyone other than their parents. So rarely that they were shy like animals.
Mm-hmm.
And she heard him banging, and she stepped up to see what it was. And she was so shy that when she came in, she wouldn't even tell Mrs. McKenzie that he was locked in there.
She didn't want to use the word toilet.
That's right.
Yes.
So he eventually broke the door down. And he came in, and he sat down and explained quickly what had happened. And when she came through that door with a plate of food in her hand for him. He glared at her, glowered at her, and her color just came up in her face. She dropped the plate on and the food on the floor and retreated. And that gives you a little illustration of some of the types of people one encountered on these places.
Yeah. How did you get on with them? Say you're in Charlotte City, your interaction with the people. Did you know them well? Or?
Yes. We got to know a fair number of people there. It was in the early days that I suppose we got to know more of them through sports and bridge than anything else. We had a few sports fixtures against. We were only five all told, five of the RCF. We'd add four locals in Queen Charlotte City to make up a baseball team, and then we played against the Indians. That was a great do and great event, and all the people from near and far would come, and the Indians would know in all their costumes, color would be there. Yeah. So, or in the evenings, occasionally we'd have a game of bridge. And in Queen Charlotte City, the wives the government officials, there were one or two government officials there, and their wives used to play bridge. They were still playing auction bridge in 1932. Contract hadn't been in vogue for very long.
Mm-hmm. And it hadn't gotten to Charlotte.
It had gotten to Charlotte, but it hadn't got to the Queen Charlotte City. It was at the Indian village at Skittigan. And when we were invited out to play auction bridge by the white members of society there, Indians invariably would get in touch with me and invite us down to pay contract, just to rub it in a little bit. We played sometimes when we played in the auction in Queen Charlotte City, we sometimes played with the Japanese members of the community. The reason I was rushed up there, my detachment, I was in charge of the detachment at that stage, mm-hmm. The reason we were rushed up there was because it had been discovered that the Japanese had a group of so-called fishermen operating under Queen Charlotte, who were surveying and plotting our harbors up and down the west coast of the Queen Charlotte Islands.
Really? Were they BC natives? Or BC?
No, they weren't. Well,
they were living in BC, though, I take it.
They were living in BC long enough to have a cover-up.
Yeah.
But the ones I'm referring to here were officers in the Japanese Navy. And they were fishermen, so-called, in quotes. And they were there with their wives, and in most cases, some of them were single. And they were legitimate fishermen.
Mm-hmm.
They were carrying on in life as fishermen. But
they would
find time to go in and map some. And at that time, it's hard to believe that as recent as 32, mm-hmm. that the Admiralty charts of the Queen Charlotte Islands had some of those harbors and bays dotted in, which meant unsurveyed.
Really?
Yeah. And these birds were in there surveying them. Well, I used to play bridge with the chap himself didn't play bridge, but with his wife I played. And they, of course, there was no alcohol available in a place like that. If you wanted to get anything to drink, you had to send to Victoria, and there was one boat every 3 weeks.
It was totally dry then?
It was totally. Well, it wasn't totally dry.
Mm-hmm.
No, but there was no authorized liquor store out there.
You could
send to Victoria,
mm-hmm.
and then the next boat would
bring it back for you.
Bring it back for you.
So there wasn't really a problem with alcohol then in Charlotte City or in like.
Oh yes, there was.
Was there?
For example, one of these Japs made sake, and he was the local bootlegger. He sold sake, and one or two others had stills,
mm-hmm.
and they sold to their friends.
How about you and the forces? Did you have any trouble with it? Did the NCOs?
No. Funnily enough, when I was up there, I was the only officer in the detachment.
Mm-hmm.
That made my position even more isolated. Normally there were two officers, but I had a senior NCO on my detachment as a pilot. We had a few NCO pilots in those days.
Mm-hmm.
Either in the rank, generally the rank of flight sergeant, flight sergeant, or warrant officer. I had a warrant officer as my second, as the other pilot. And I just remember now, he did go ill at one stage, so I did have an officer in there replacing him, but normally there were just the two of us. What was your question there?
Alcoholism.
Yeah, alcoholism. Well, I don't imagine that my NCOs had more than a few drinks the whole time we were up there. You know, we were up there for several months.
Would it be confined, say, a Saturday evening or a Friday?
Yeah. It would be confined to boat day. Because drinking only took place, really, to an extent on boat day.
And when that was through, there was...
And the boat used to come in late afternoon. The alcohol was all gone before the next morning, so that was it. There'd be a 3 weeks drought. But myself and the other officer and my warrant officer sometimes went into the Jap place because I knew what he was up to.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't know that I knew what he was up to. He didn't know really what we were up there for, I suppose. And so I thought it was a part of my duty to keep in touch with them. I'd go in and have a bit of bootleg sake with them from time to time, and engage. They'd sit down, engage in conversation. It was a little social affair. It wasn't done on any other basis. You sit down and have a drink with them and talk with them when you're having a sake.
Mm-hmm. So. I take it they spoke fairly good English.
Yeah, fair. You had to be a little on the alert to catch it all. Well,
let me ask you another question pertaining to Charlotte City. You're isolated, and I'm thinking primarily of the enlisted, or the NCOs, because they probably would have been older than you.
Yes,
were.
They were.
Were they married, or...?
They were married.
So I suppose the aspect of women didn't come into play here, or...?
Not normally. I think my corporal squire was a bit sweet on this girl that wouldn't let him out of the lavatory.
Oh, the shy girl.
how far he got with the shy girl, I never knew. And there were one or two. There wasn't really any much evidence of prostitution on the island.
Mm-hmm.
I think some of the females are a little free, but there was no pay prostitution.
I suppose it was so isolated that it...
Yeah, I know. I mentioned the village of Skittigat. That's where the Indians were. That's where the Haida... The Queen Charlotte's is the locale of the Haida Indian, and they're a fine tribe, and some very nice people. And they had a nice community. They had nice homes down there, and relatively speaking. And they had a nice community center. When we were invited down there to play bridge, we generally played in their community center.
Mm-hmm.
They had a fine... well-organized community and good band and good community spirit. And
mm-hmm.
They were fishermen, too. They had their fishing boats, and they did pretty well in fishing season. But midway between Queen Charlotte City and Skittigat, there was a little halfway village, I can't remember what it was called now, in which there were the half-breeds, I suppose, mainly.
Mm-hmm.
And sometime rather than been a Negro shipwrecked on the islands, and there were some half Negro and half Indian in there. And that fellow's name was Stevens. He was a pretty fine fellow, and he had quite a nice family. But his daughters were out to grab an airman if they could. And it was quite obvious that they felt that an airman would be a good catch. So mm-hmm. I used to set their nets for. The NCOs. I suppose they wouldn't have been against grabbing an officer if they could. But and Stevens always got a bottle or two of rum and come in on the ship. So he'd have a little party
mm-hmm.
on boat night, and that would give the girls an opportunity. Well, that's I guess about enough of that. Stevens, I remember one day being down there in the dock, and he said, it was when we first went out there, our aircraft are moored out at moorings, you know,
mm-hmm.
and we were often down there in the dock running in and out with boats. And he said to me, when I first got to know him, I think that I can claim kinship with you. He was this Negro. I said, well, that's interesting. How's that come about? He said, well, he said, I've just discovered you're from Nova Scotia. And he said, my mother was a Scotch lass from Nova Scotia. So he was, although he looked quite full-blooded Negro, he must have been half and half. So you had an interesting mixture. And, of course, there were some great characters in a place like Queen Charlotte City, many of whom were products of the Klondike Gold Rush. And they'd been, of course, a lot of the people went up that coast, went through Prince Rupert and on up to Skagway and on into Whitehorse and into Yukon that way. Some of them got quite bushed in there in the years they were in the Yukon. And when they got back as far as Prince Rupert and saw civilization, in quotes, and they couldn't take it. And they heard that there was a nice place over in Queen Charlotte City that might suit them. And quite a number went over and lived in Queen Charlotte City, most of them bachelors, and became recluses, and more or less. But you got to know some of those fellows, and they were real characters.
35 years after the fact, I suppose, they were pushing 70, 60.
Yeah, and that's right. That's right. I can remember one old fellow there. He was very pleasant. He looked a little like Santa Claus, but he was soft. He was a bit weak up top, but he had a little hut and a few amenities in it. And he had a radio, one of those little tiny old-fashioned radios. I guess it was sort of shaped like this, you know. They built them like a clock at one time.
Those old crystal radios.
Yeah. It wasn't a crystal, it had one tube, I would think. I can remember asking him on one occasion if he had listened to such and such a program. And he said, well, when was that? What time was that? And I said, oh, it was about 10:30. Oh, he said, I never, never keep it on after 10. I said, why? He said, oh, I think those fellows must be getting pretty tired by that time. And I always shut it off. He was quite serious. Yeah.
Well, tell me a bit about Jericho Beach.
Jericho Beach, all right. Jericho Beach was a small base, and every structure on it dated from just after World War I.
Now, is that the same structures that are on it now?
No. No. The buildings that were there when I went there was a double hangar, which housed the seaplanes and a large parking apron out in front where you could leave aircraft outside if you needed to, if you wished to. There was a small stores building. There was a small building that acted as a headquarters. It was smaller than a small house, really. The CO had his office there, and the ADJ and the orderly room staff, which consisted of two or three people, and the MT section, motor transport section, which I think there were two cars. And at a pigeon loft. You know, we used to use pigeons in those early days, carrier really? Pigeons, as a safety measure, because we were operating without benefit of radio in the beginning. And if you got forced down by bad weather, and there was no good net service, you released the pigeon from the crates you were carrying and put a message on and sent it back to tell where you were.
And this is the 1920s,
1930s? Yeah. The pigeon loft went out of use in the late 20s. And that little tiny shack, which wouldn't be as big as this room, was converted to a medical inspection room. And I can remember one day, the morning parade had just taken place. There was a form up and a roll call down there on that tarmac where the aircraft were. And it had just dismissed some of the boys had gone over to the MIR. I guess there were some in the MIR during the parade. And obviously the NCO in charge of the medical section had given one of these chaps a gargle. But the room was so small, the section was so small, they'd had to stand outside to do his gargling. And he was out there with his head up there, sort of going like this, gargling away. And this whole body of troops thought that he was seeing an aircraft away up in the sky. And it was the funniest sight to see everybody, all There must have been 40 or 50 of them.
Oh, they're looking up, searching around there, and then eventually looking back at him, whereupon he just spit out onto the ground, and the look of disgust on all these faces. There was one other little tiny building, and again, it wouldn't be more than 12 by 16, and that was our photographic attachment headquarters.